Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Now, it's time for Playing with Fire with Chef Tom and Stu at the new 104.7 WHLI. Brought to you by Santa Giada Pinot Grigio.
But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell. Here on this Sunday morning, and I'm here with producer and co-host Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. I'm really beginning to get concerned about the weather.
What's your concern?
Well, here it is. We're halfway through April, and I'm expecting spring.
Still chilly, right?
It's been a little chilly.
You know, I remember years ago, I was working in, I think the year was 1969 or 70. I think it was 70. I was working in a restaurant in Westbury, and we had a blizzard on Easter Sunday, like 3 feet of snow. It was in like maybe the first week of April. So you never really out of the weeds until you get to May. You know what I mean? You just got to get through it. So it can be chilly, and you know, spring flowers and all of that stuff notwithstanding. You know, I've had a couple of knee-knocking golf rounds this spring so far where it was like 50 degrees and howling wind. So hopefully we're, you know, that's in the rearview mirror, and we're going to head into May, and the flowers will bloom and the sun will come out and everything will be fine.
Well, I hope you are right.
You want me to sing Tomorrow now for Manny, you know, and give you a couple of bars?
So, you know, like in a series, when we last spent some time with you, Tom, you were about to celebrate your birthday.
I did. I celebrated the birthday. The age doesn't matter because I only act like I'm a year younger than I am. But, yeah, the birthday was fun. I got to tell you a funny story. My daughter took my two grandchildren to the dollar store to let them pick out birthday gifts for me, you know. You want to hear what I got?
Can only imagine.
Well, I got a pair of red kitchen, home red plastic kitchen tongs. I got a little strainer. I got a pair of light blue diabetic compression socks. I got a pair of gardening gloves, size small. What else? I got a St. Jude candle, which I guess I can light and pray that I make it into the 70s. Trying to think of what else. I got a butterfly net. I got a plastic bat and a little wiffle ball. I think that was a hint for my grandson. I got three jars of bubbles in case I get bored at the club or at the restaurant. I can go out and blow a few into the air. I'm trying to think of what else.
And this is all for a dollar.
This is all for a dollar. And I got a little car that comes with this like little spongy thing that you step on and the car shoots off. I guess with the air compression, the car shoots across the room. So yeah, it was interesting. I got two cards that said Happy Mother's Day, Paco, and I got one Happy 3-year-old. You finally made it to three. So it was quite the amusing birthday, to tell you the truth. But the kids were fun. They were all excited about it. You know, I got to the house, and I guess my daughter was still decorating the table. You know, she had all this birthday stuff out. My granddaughter came running out. She goes, Paco, you can't go in the house. Mommy's using dangerous chemicals in the bathroom. And I'm like, really? What are they? I've probably ingested them at some point in my life, you know? So we were laughing about that. And the kids, they're so cute, you know? But listen, I have a story to tell you.
I wasn't sure if the story you just told was the story off air you told me you were going to tell me.
No. I got to tell you, and before anybody makes any comments on this, just hear me out, okay? Because it's like one of these things that it's a first-time thing for me. So are you familiar with planting fields, arboretum?
Yes. Right? I can't say the third word, but planting fields I've heard of.
Yeah, just call it garden. It's easier. So somebody got me involved in this fundraising charity thing, right, where they auction me off like chattel. Dinner, right? So I got to go, I got to bring the food, I got to make the dinner, I got to pick the wines and, you know, whatever. And it raises money for whatever I don't remember what the cause was. So it was a dinner for 12 people, and they spent a considerable amount of money on this, or donated it, I should say, a considerable amount of money. So I have to go and I have to do the dinner, right? Now, the dinner takes place at the Planet Fields Arboretum in Coe Hall, COE. So Coe Hall is this huge mansion that's on the property that I guess is a, you know, a relic like a lot of the country clubs up there from the old industrialist days, you know, Phipps and all of those. They all had estates out here on what they called the country on Long Island. And they were built, you know, in the late 1800s or the turn of the century, whatever, for millions of dollars back then. So they're magnificent. So Coe Hall is a 65-room manse on this property. And you have to see it. I mean, they have furniture and tapestries that are 400 years old that nobody can sit on. You know, they got a warning, don't touch this, don't touch that. It's really a museum, in essence. So the dinner was going to take place in the main dining room of this mansion, right? So they have the table set for 12 people. It's a big, long table. And they have special tablecloths on it because they don't want to damage the table. It's this relic that's, you know, priceless or whatever. So I get to the kitchen, and there's no oven in the kitchen, right? Which I knew from before because, you know, I had gone and scoped it out, right? But there was this huge center island. It was probably about 15 to 16 feet long and about 4 feet wide with a sink in the middle. So I set up a couple of burners, right? I had two burners on the right-hand side, two burners on the left-hand side. Now, behind me was a refrigerator and then shelving, you know, like waist-high, like table-high shelving. And on in the corner, there was a tabletop oven that, you know, worked. It was an electric oven. And behind me, there was also a microwave. So this is what I had to deal with, right? So they come in, and everybody's, you know, having champagne, and they're talking, and we can't get them to sit down. I don't really want to rush them because they spent a lot of money for this thing, and we're all grateful for the charity and this, that, and the other thing. So I guess it's it was supposed to start at 5:30. By the time they finally sat down, it was almost 7 o'clock, right? So I'm working with two waiters who I brought from the club, and the curator of, or the, you know, the manager of the property was in and out. And each course was, you know, served with a separate wine. So me being a wino, you know, I kind of know the wines. I picked them out. So anyway, I said, you know, when you pour the wine, don't forget El Jefe over here because, you know, I like to taste them as they go out. So the first wine was a Sparkling Point Topaz, you know, the rosé champagne sparkler, right? The second one was a Pinot Gris from Oregon, Voice de Vin, it's called. And the third one was a Rulli from Burgundy, right? So I have the three of them. As the meal's going out, they pour me a half a glass of each. And I couldn't get to them at the moment because I'm working and trying to do this dinner. And so I put them in the refrigerator behind me, the glasses in the refrigerator behind me. So as things are winding down a little and I'm getting a little more like time between courses, I took the white Burgundy, which was my favorite, and I put it on the end of the counter because it was a little cold, right? I wanted to warm it up a little bit. So I put it on the end of the counter, and I'm going about my business, and I'm you know, putting out a lobster course or whatever it was, you know? And, you know, at the end, I'm like, ah, that was great. Okay, everything went out, looked great, you know, tastes good, everybody's happy. I'm going to have a sip of my wine. And I go down to the, you know, I look down at the end where the wine was, and there's no wine there. It's gone. So I'm looking around. I'm like, well, I'm thinking, did I take it somewhere? Did I move? Did I bring it with me? I know I left it there, you know. And I'm looking all around the kitchen. I can't find the wine, right? There's nowhere to be found. So one of the waiters comes back. I said, Giovanni, did you take my wine off there? He goes, no, I didn't touch your wine, you know. Betsy, did you take the, did you move? No. Did you mistakenly take it and put it in? No, we didn't touch it. It's gone, right? So I jokingly say to this curator lady, I said, you got a ghost living in here? I can't find my wine's gone, you know? She goes, well, you know, they've been rumored, you know, I don't know, maybe, yeah. All right. So now it's getting towards dessert, right? And one of the ladies was celebrating a birthday. So we brought these sparklers. You've probably seen them in restaurants. They're kind of big, and they shoot a bunch of sparklers up until, you know, for like 40 seconds. And there's these little tube things that are about, I don't know, maybe a half inch in diameter. And they come in four packs, right? Now, I didn't bring them. The waiters brought them. So when I came in, I unloaded my stuff. I had a bus box, which is about maybe, you know, 2.5 feet by a foot and a half and maybe, I don't know, excuse me, 8 inches deep. And I had a lot of stuff in there. I had my knives in there. I had spoons and tongs and ladles and spatulas and things that I need. And on top of that, I had some frying pans, you know, sauté pans in various sizes, all in that bucket, right? So that bucket was behind me on the shelf. So when the waiters came, I said, make sure you bring some water, because I don't know if they have water there. And don't forget the sparklers. Okay, fine. So they bring the water and the sparklers. I put the water on the counter in the bag next to my bus box of tools, and I place the four sparklers in the pack next to the water. And I said to the waitress, I said, Betsy, the sparklers are over here just so in case we're running around later, you know, we forgot where we put them. They're right here. Okay, fine. It's getting towards dessert. I said, Betsy, get the sparkler ready because I'm going to get the dessert course ready. She goes over there. Sparklers are gone. Can't find them, right? So now, did we bring them in? I'm not sure. I don't know. The waiter's out checking the car. You know, did we drop them on the way in? We're checking the grounds. I'm looking underneath. I'm moving tables. I'm opening the refrigerator. Maybe, you know, I have Alzheimer's. I put them someplace else. Gone, right? Can't find them. So now we're like to the lady. I said, this is getting creepy, man. You know, I know I had them right here, you know, and Betsy saw them. So anyway, I said to her, do you have candles? Because now I don't have the sparklers. Oh, I'm going to find a candle. So she's running around trying to find candles. I'm kind of cleaning up after the last course. So I scrub out this saute pan, and I go to put it back in a bus box. But it was bigger than the ones that were sitting there. So I lifted up the smaller ones to put the bigger one underneath. And there are the sparklers under my knives and spoons in the bus box. I'm like, this is the Twilight Zone, man. I know where I put them, right? So now I'm getting dessert ready. I'm still freaking out over this thing. And now I'm convinced there's something going on. You know, either somebody's screwing around with me, I have Alzheimer's, or there's a ghost in this place, right? And I know I'm not crazy yet, right? So that's number one's out. Number two, the waiters are terrified of me, so I know they wouldn't do that, right? So anyway, I get this dessert. It's a flourless chocolate cake with a hazelnut, this, that, and the other thing. I won't go into it. But I had a bag of hazelnuts that were roasted off that I was going to crush and use as a decorative garnish on the plate. But I wanted to save 12 of them, 12 whole ones, that I could place them on top of the whipped cream on top of the flourless cake. Right? So I picked 12 of the most beautiful hazelnuts you ever saw in your life out of this bag, and I put them in a glass, and I put it at the end of the counter where my now red wine is, you know. So I get the two glasses down there. I crush the hazelnuts. I sprinkle them around. I decorate the desserts. I get the whipped cream out. I pipe the whipped cream on top of the desserts. I go to get the hazelnuts and the glass are gone. Now, I'm the only one in the kitchen. So I've lost a glass of wine. I had the sparklers move from the counter into my bus bucket under my tools. And now I have 12 hazelnuts and a wine glass disappeared. So I said to the lady, there's something going on here. She goes, please don't creep me out. I got to be here for another hour after you people leave by myself cleaning up. So I said to my daughter the next day, you know, I'm not exactly the mamby-pamby kind of guy that's afraid of his own shadow kind of thing. I said, but I got to tell you, that creeped me out. And yesterday, you know, if somebody would have told me the story, I would have had one eyebrow up and, yeah, whatever, you know. I'm a believer now, Stu. I'm telling you, I know what I saw. I know what happened. I was there. I'm a believer.
Well, let me interact with you on this. being a big fan of Broadway, I've always been told of the ghost light, and it's a historical part of Broadway. And a ghost light is a single bulb left burning whenever a theater is dark. Some agree that its function is to chase away mischievous spirits. Others insist it lights the way for the ghosts that are said to inhabit virtually every theater, keeping them happy and content. Either way, the light ensures that no one takes an accidental tumble off the stage.
Well, yeah, there's some wisdom in that.
So that's always something that's, you know, I've heard about or whatever. But I guess there might be something to all this, and maybe for another discussion on another Sunday, all about this connection with people that have passed and stuff. I don't know what your take is on that. But again, I think it should be another conversation. But there's a lot of people that feel they get signs.
Oh, yeah. Cardinals and all that stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, but I would really like to get the Tom Shawdell take on that. But I think I'd like to have a lot of time for that with you.
This was the creepiest thing that's ever happened to me. And what are the chances I get a ghost who likes white burgundies? You know what I mean? You couldn't have taken a Pinot Gris.
That's the other thing. Burgundy, I always associate I guess by color, but also as a red wine. And Burgundy is a region.
Yes.
In France.
In France.
So I don't think of Burgundy as a white wine. So I'm intrigued by that, and I need to experience that.
Well, you know, in Burgundy, they make basically reds and whites. I'm sure somebody makes a rosé somewhere, but, you know, they're not known for that. The whites are 90%, well, probably 95% Chardonnay. There is a grape called Aligoté that's grown in Burgundy that's white, and it's delicious, actually, and a bargain compared to the Burgundies. And the reds in Burgundy are probably 90% Pinot Noir. And then they have this other thing called Beaujolais, which is also in Burgundy, and that's made from Gamay, which is the other grape that they grow in Burgundy. But apparently, maybe a ghost being white, you know, didn't want to spill any red juice on his outfit there, you know what I mean?
So it can stain.
But I'm thinking, of all the ghosts that are out there, you know, and I'm sure there are plenty. You know, I get one that likes hazelnuts and white Burgundy. And a playful sucker, too, by the way. I mean, you know, screwing around
got
with
the
my...
the best of you.
Yeah, I mean, screwing around with my sparklers and stuff. It was quite the experience, I got to tell you.
You know, my mind wanders to the thing that I just told you about on Broadway in the ghost light, and with the almost 2 years of Broadway being closed, did they have lights on within the theater all the time? And then who was responsible?
Yeah, I mean, you need a bulb changer at that point. How many ghosts does it take to change a light?
That will be a good research project
somewhere. Anyway, so I don't know if I told you, but I went to this Burgundy tasting in the city a couple of weeks ago.
It's all about Burgundy.
Today's a Burgundy day, I guess. You know, I get Burgundy on the brain, and I tasted through maybe 40 or 50. White and red Burgundies, which were just magnificent. I mean, 2020 is quite the year in Burgundy. If anybody wants to just, you know, buy futures or, you know, cop some great wines, the 2020 Burgundies are fabulous. And so afterwards, I went to Marea, which is one of my favorite restaurants in the city, and had a couple of pastas. I had a great pasta with sea urchin and another one with octopus and bone marrow, which is my all-time favorite.
I have my hand up. May I interrupt for a
second? Yes, you may.
Maria, is that the restaurant that has now a Long Island location at Roosevelt Field?
Well, it's the same guy, but it's a different name. That's Marini.
Oh.
Maria means sea, I guess, in Italian. So, you know, Maria meaning ocean or sea, water, whatever. It's basically kind of like a coastal Italian thing, you know. Marini means, you know, I don't know, mafioso last name or something, I don't know, in Italian. So that's a little more like, he calls it a Roman trattoria, you know. It's more Roman in its cuisine. But I tell you what, they got great pastas there, too. I mean, if you ever get a chance, they're in Roosevelt Field. If you're staring at the place, it's just to the left of Nordstrom. I think it's Nordstrom. No, not Nordstrom.
Neiman Marcus.
Neiman Marcus, yeah. Just in the, you can tell you what a clothes horse I am. I don't know the difference between the two. But, yeah, it's great restaurant. I mean, you know, all his food's really good. His pastas are exceptional. And I get there like once every 2 or 3 months. You know, I'll stop in there and just load up on carbs, you know, because I love them so much.
So this is the most bizarre take on that restaurant, because I believe I have dined there. And not that at most restaurants there is a uniform, but I thought that there was no dress code per se for the help.
Yeah.
And it was very confusing figuring out who worked there and who didn't.
It's funny, you know, the casualization of restaurants has gone to the point where you know, I guess there's all kinds of phases. I remember, you know, when I first started in a restaurant in the late 60s, you know, you had those waitress uniforms that were kind of like jumpers or whatever the women call those things. It's kind of a onesie piece, you know, with the skirt and a zipper up the front, you know, usually in a bad color, red or yellow or whatever. And they still have them at the Modern Snack Bar, which is nothing modern about it out there in Aquabog, you know. Great restaurant, too, by the way. It's a lot of fun. It's a nostalgic trip through Dinerville, you know. But, you know, and then there was the whole, you know, black tuxedo, and I was in a restaurant. I won't tell you which one it is because I don't want to hurt the guy's feelings, but there was a maitre d', and when he came out, I went, whoa, Captain Steubing, you know? He had one of those white, you know, like captain's jackets on, you know, with the brushes off the shoulder or whatever. Epaulettes, I guess. Is it called epaulettes? Is that what
yes.
that is? Yeah. So anyway, and you know, that's all gone, you know, through these phases. And now it's kind of like the jeans with the leather straps, you know, the dungaree, you know, apron. And, you know, all the chefs have ink from their shoulder to their wrists, you know. And, you know, they get these long beards that I guess they stir their sauces with or whatever, you know. So it's just become kind of cartoonish now, you know. It's like the biker thing, you know, and, you know, the bikers were always, well, 1% of the population were all kind of unique, but, you know, everybody had the same uniform. They all had the chain on a wallet and the Harley Davidson shirt from somewhere, you know, and it's the same with chefs now, you know, all these chefs, I think that they're spending more time on the look than they are on the food.
This is crazy. This is so unscripted, but I was at Suffolk Harley yesterday,
mm-hmm.
and I was looking.
The one in Oakdale?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was looking at wallet chains.
Were you?
And there you are talking about biker chains.
Well, I'm very tapped into the afterlife. You know, I'm...
But how psychic is that?
Yeah, I'm a regular Kreskin. I'm talking to ghosts on Saturday, yelling at them, where's my sparklers? And then, like, I'm reading your mind. This could be another career for me. Who knows? You know? Anyway, let's take a little break and we'll sell some commercial time and make some money and we'll chat about food when we get back.
Start your weekend with Santa Giada Pinot Grigio, a product of Savorian Inc., a local import wine company operated by Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander. Enjoy the crisp, refreshing flavors of peach and green apple in this medium-bodied, creamy mouthfeel wine that pairs with many foods. Santa Giada Pinot Grigio is exclusively available at Stu Leonard's Wines and Spirits of Farmingdale and Ryan's Wines in East Meadow. For more wine suggestions like Santa Giada Pinot Grigio, just email Chad at SavorianWine.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI and 104.7 WHLI FM, Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shawdell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
Yeah, so I heard we got some news.
This is really, really incredible news. And we have a lot of... communications with our listeners through fire@whli.com, fire@whli.com. And since we don't do any advertising for the show, really, it's all word of mouth. And we appreciate all our listeners for sharing their like
Absolutely.
And enjoyment
oh,
of
yeah.
the show. But I got really incredible news this week. And that relates to ratings. And what's incredible, not shocking because I know how talented you are and your effervescent personality, but Playing with Fire is the second most listened to show on Sunday mornings on Long Island. We have what they call just shy of a 10 share. We have a 9.9. Share of the audience, which means that there are approximately 7,600 people listening to our radio show every Sunday morning.
Wow.
Now, what's incredible about this is we're number two, and what was that old commercial with Hertz and Avis?
Hertz, yeah.
We try harder.
Yeah, we try harder. Yeah.
But so we're second to the Beatles.
I thought we were first, and Beatles were second.
So... The most listened to show on Sunday mornings on Long Island is The Beatles Brunch on Q104
right.
with Ken Daschau.
Right.
So second to that is us, which is incredible. But I'm talking about beating the other radio stations on Long Island, the city stations. Again, people listening to radio on Sunday mornings between 9 a.m. and 10 a.m., we are the second most popular show.
That, you know, I always wanted to be bigger than the Beatles, but, you know, so now I have something to shoot for, you know. They have a bigger catalog than I have, though. You know, they got more to work with.
So I have to protect myself, though, because around the radio station, I tend to say I And it's never I with Playing With Fire, because it's all about you, Tom Shawdell.
No, no, it's a collaboration.
So I ride your coattails. But so it's just very funny in the office and in the sales area. And I get attacked. So I'm saying this on the air so that when somebody comes up to you, you know,
and ask me for your autograph.
But what's incredible is the radio station had a celebratory happy hour this past week to celebrate that 94.3 The Shark, our sister station,
right.
A radio station that features the music of Nirvana, Green Day, Alice in Chains, that type of stuff. I guess it's millennial rock.
Right.
So it's the younger version of what other stations might play as far as rock. But they were celebrating their tremendous ratings and number one morning show. But the boss here, he had to step back for a second and congratulate us.
Really? Wow, that was very nice of him.
So it's to have a 9.9 share is really a big deal.
Well, I've never had a 9.9 share before, so I'm going to have to hang that up in my can you frame that? Or
we'll have to do something, but I have to ask you some retrospective questions here because I'm not up on it. The history of Playing With Fire, I know that I've been in this business almost 22 years.
Right.
And I believe I knew of you through your restaurants. And,
right.
And actually, when I started dating Kerry, you had a restaurant in Merrick.
Mm-hmm. Starfish.
Starfish.
Yeah.
And then somehow there was a Starfish in Great Neck. I don't know if there was an affiliation.
No, I had nothing to do with
but
that.
But your Starfish was in Merrick.
Yeah.
And this is actually getting the wheels in my head moving. And it was there for a couple of years. Very nice restaurant. The neighborhood loved it.
Right.
But it was just the way you say that music and things like that, you know, sort of showcase dates in your mind.
Yeah, it frees the moment.
It was a period of my life because I had just met Kerry, and if I was around during a weekday, we would dine there. And it was an interesting ambiance there. It was almost like a modern...
Yeah, well, it was a converted Nick and Tony's. Not Nick and Tony's. That's in East Hampton. Chris and Tony's. It's something Tony's. It was a Sbarro restaurant. I had partnered with Sbarro to change some things that they were doing.
So I remember it was sort of like 1960s modern furniture. The seats were like sort of formica.
Yeah.
If I recollect, it was... it was seafood. Believe it or not, there's not a lot of seafood restaurants in that area on the South Shore.
Or Long Island, tell you the truth.
So yeah. How bizarre is that? But so at any rate, I knew of Tom Shawdell. Cool Fish, I guess, was around at that time.
Yeah.
Tom also came to be initially around that time.
Yes.
And so I knew of you. And then I guess September 11th happened. And we were doing things at the mall, and we wanted to do maybe something at the holidays, and we showcased you. There was a booth at Roosevelt Field Mall with a TV, and I think you did some cooking demos.
Yeah, I still haven't forgiven you for that.
Yeah. So from there, I actually remember we decided to pitch you on a radio show. And if you
remember, know, no, what we did was we had you brought me in here to kind of relay some of the stories in my book with Jim and Kim, the morning duo.
Okay,
that's
yes,
how it started.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And then the infinite wisdom of Dave Widmer,
yes,
at the time, who ran the radio stations, and you and him used to have these really in-depth talks about the Grateful Dead and music in general.
Yeah,
but We then morphed from that segment on the Jim and Kim show to having a show of your own. And it's so interesting that you just said the Jim and Kim show, because we pitched your co-host to be Kim Burke.
Yes.
And Kim, who's usually like Johnny on the spot, was dogging it. She wouldn't commit.
Yeah, yeah.
Little did I know, or any of us know, that Jim and Kim were leaving the radio station
to
go
city,
into
right?
the city.
Yeah.
So Kim ultimately said, I can't do it.
Right.
Which led to your first co-host, Malibu Sue.
Yeah, I love Malibu Sue. She's great.
A legendary heritage
DJ, yeah.
DJ, on-air personality here on Long Island at WLIR, which has been in the media the past couple of years because it was a documentary written about the radio station, how it was this little nothing, yet it led the crusade of punk and British invasion.
Yeah, it did. It was really in the forefront of that.
And then you take it to the nth degree. This was just the other day. I had to, as a producer, schedule an interview with Duran Duran, which was like the heyday of WLIR and one of the up-and-coming bands of that time. So it's just really cool that we're talking about Malibu Sue and WLIR. Which was, I guess, 92.7, I believe.
92.7. My daughter worked there for a while.
Really? Oh, that's right. That's how she knows our Rob Rush and Sean Lynch. But so Malibu Sue was your co-host for many years. And do you remember what year we might have started Playing with Fire?
Well, yeah, I think it was 2010.
Okay. So at that time, there really were no... they call it long, 30-minute radio shows on the air here. So you had the first one, and then all of a sudden, I guess it was Dave Widmer's idea. We ended up having a number of these type of shows, but nobody could keep it going. And as you can attest to, the curse of the dead would be to have your picture on the wall.
Yeah, you don't want your picture on the wall at the station.
So when you came into the lobby at the radio station, there would be each radio station logo, and then there would be the traditional on-air personalities, and then there would be the host of these different half-hour radio shows. And everybody was quick to put these different pictures up. And once the picture went up, the show,
it was the beginning and the end. It's like Taps, what I mean?
So go think about it. Being that you said the show started in 2010, that means the show's been running for about 12 years, which is incredible because nobody's had the tenacity to keep it going. And talk about challenges. You know, here at the radio station, there's been different ownership, different managers. You went from having a full hour program to one point, some genius decided they were going to give you a half hour.
Yeah. I can't.
And they moved it to 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
Then they had another great idea. They said, you want more? We'll give you 45 minutes.
I know, it's like...
And I know you had a lot of in-depth research going into it, but you were scratching your head and you were saying, wow, I'm not sure how many 45-minute shows there might be in the marketplace, or the world for that matter. Then again, they had moved us to 6 o'clock, or your show to like 6 o'clock. And I don't know, if you're doing an hour show, I guess it usually flows better to be at the top of the hour.
Sure.
But then they gave you like 6:30 to 7:30. And then they decided to give you back your hour.
Yeah.
And along the way, Malibu Sue, who actually hosted a show on Max FM, 103.1 Max FM, which was known as B103 back then. I believe Jim did mornings, or Bill Wise, the wise man, did mornings, and Malibu Sue did the midday shift. But once she transitioned and left the radio station, you had no co-host again, and the show sort of stopped airing. Malibu Sue went on to doing some traffic reporting, I think, for 1010 WINS in the city, where I think she still does that a little bit part-time, but she went into a different
area.
Career.
Yeah.
But again, she came into focus because Newsday did a showcase on her recently because of the WLIR documentary.
Yeah.
But again, so the show sort of stalled, and through some craziness, I just had this desire for you to keep the show going. I was just such a big proponent of it because we had so much fun. Again, even myself, in a producer role, not being on air, but we interviewed
yeah, people who didn't speak English. A guy who sang through the whole thing. We had a couple of memorable.
Oh, Frankie Pellegrino.
Yeah,
Frankie. Which was from Rao's. And his name was, his nickname was Frankie No, because everybody would want to eat at Rao's and he would say no. And I have to, that was one of the funniest things, because I think I created the role of Matt Solomon, Solly, our producer at one point, who would always interrupt our show when, when I was involved with you. But when Frank Pellegrino was on, I kept wanting to get a reservation at Rao's, because going way back, Dean Anthony used to be the program director in WHOI, and that's how I developed a relationship with Frank. And Dean actually had his picture up on the wall. And if Dean wanted to eat at Rao's, he got to eat at Rao's. And I wanted to dine at Rao's. And so during the show, you know, I think even you were asking for a table. And Frank said, you know, forget about it.
What's funny, you know, what's funny about that whole thing is, like, I mean, he's a nice enough guy, Frank. And he's dead, so now I can talk bad about him. But, you know, he's got this restaurant, Rao's, which is, you know, okay, it's legendary because, you know, a couple of mafia guys got shot there or whatever, you know. It's not about the food. It's about, you know, 46 seats, and, you know, 2,000 people want the 46 seats. So, you know, good for him. But, I mean, I have no burning desire to eat baked clams and eggplant parmesan, you know. But I kind of was curious about it. You know, what's the big deal? Hey, you know, can you, you know, now that we've given you this airtime, can you give us a table? No. I'm, like, thinking, cares, you know what I
but
mean?
But what's also funny about I think we had Frank on maybe twice.
Twice, yeah.
The first time he thought it was going to be like a 5-minute segment. He lived in Rockville Center at the time, but he comes here, he parks the car, he leaves his wife in the car with the engine running, and he goes, oh, this is going to be an hour?
Maybe he's hoping she falls asleep, you know?
Like, I don't know. Maybe
he got a hit. He had a hit on his wife.
But yeah, no, so we had Frank Pellegrino. We've interviewed Emeril,
Martha Stewart, Alex Guarnaschelli.
Yeah, we did. Who's the Lydia?
Lydia, yeah.
We've actually
Lydia's the nicest lady. I love her. She's great.
We actually had some good time. We interviewed Jesse Bon Jovi,
yeah,
who is the founder with his dad, legendary rock singer John Bon Jovi.
Yeah, Hampton Waters.
Rose. And I want to look into that, because I wonder what that brand is doing, because as part of our interview over the couple of times we interviewed him, there was discussion about expanding the brand and if they were going to get involved in anything else or just concentrate.
Yeah, it hasn't happened yet.
On what they had. But, you know, it's interesting. For Passover this past week, I went down to Stu Leonard's, and I was looking for a rosé. It's funny, again, how you label things, but Wolfer Estates has a Summer in a Bottle,
mm-hmm.
And the new vintage just came out.
Right.
But they also went from a domestic brand, they also now have an imported.
Yeah, he makes a lot of wine in Chile.
I said to myself, you know what? I'm not sharing that with my family. That's something me and Kerry do, and I love sharing that with our friends. And then I was thinking about the Hampton Water, and I was saying to myself, you know what? I want to do a taste test, like have a flight. I want to do the Hampton Water. I want to do the Summer in a Bottle. And then now there's the two Summer in a Bottle. So there's some. I'd be curious to see if I can
What you should do is do that blind, though. It's this way you really get the one you like.
But to complicate things, I asked about, what is it, George Berthaud or something? Who's the...
DeBoeuf?
Is that the guy that does the wine with Bon Jovi?
No, that's... I think it's Jean-Luc Colombo.
We'll have to clarify that. But at any rate, he had a great influence with John and Jesse Bon Jovi in the creation of their wine. Not only was it the taste of the wine, but it was also the presentation, the bottle. Hampton Water has a concave bottom. I guess most wines do, but it's usually like smooth circle or whatever.
Yeah.
But Hampton Water actually has the imprint of a inverted strawberry.
That's right.
And this George, whoever, Gerard, it's Gerard something, and I'll look it up when you're talking, but his has, I believe, a rose. I think his similar rosé is Fleur de Rose or something.
Uh-huh.
But the salesperson over at Stu Lennon said, you know, I really like this. It's got a little better taste. So I bought that. But again, what's also, to me, unique, but I know it's becoming more and more popular, is the glass corks, both
yeah.
Hampton Water and the...
I first saw those in Austrian wines. There was a bunch of Gruner Veltliners that had them. I don't really know what the... it's got to be a cost thing. I don't really know what the advantage to that is. You know, I get the screw cap thing, you know, because it you know, preserves the wine. I guess the glass does the same thing. There's no air leakage or whatever, you know. And you can put them back in. There's that little click that happens, you know, when you open them up and you close them again. But it's funny how some people still revile in horror, you know, when you bring a screw cap wine to the table. And those, what they're called Stelvin caps. Those Stelvin caps are really ensures the wine is going to be, you know, intact when you get it. You know, there's no air leakage or it.
I got to interrupt. I don't want to say I told you so.
What is it?
But the guy's name is Gerard Bertrand.
Bertrand.
I think if we roll back the tape, I'm pretty close to have originally saying that.
You did. You said George, which is Gerard in French or whatever.
But at any rate, again, just talking about Playing with Fire in history, it's been incredible. The only other show that I'm associated with here at the radio station is with Suffolk AME, where they have a show called Suffolk Matters. And then real quick, it makes me... It's pretty cool that both shows that we're associated with here have interesting names. Obviously, Playing with Fire is a pretty cool name.
Sure.
Suffolk Matters, which is a show Suffolk AME has, which is the union that works with all the Suffolk County municipal workers. So Suffolk Matters is a pretty cool name.
Yeah, it's got the double entendre.
But their show's been running for 4 years, and just like you, you know, it's hard to do something on a weekly basis. Again, these other people, they would record one show and the same show would be broadcast week after week after week.
Yeah.
It's totally crazy. But Suffolk AME and yourself during COVID just kept it going. Suffolk AME used to come in and record 3 or 4 shows and then not come to the studio for a week.
Yeah.
And coincidentally, just yesterday, they were in the studio and recorded 3 shows for the first time in 2 years, because what they did is every week come in to make sure that they did their show. And the only difference is their show is Dan Leveler, who's the president of Suffolk AME, hosts and has guests. And usually there's live guests in the studio. During COVID, we went to people calling in and but again, for 4 years, they've been able to manage it. But that's nothing compared to your 12-year record.
Well, you know, the thing is, in their defense, I mean, you know, the shows that didn't make it or ceased, whatever. You know, I have subject matter that everybody deals with 3 days, 3 times a day, you know, 365 days a year. And I have a constant regeneration of ingredients and you combine that with cooking techniques and restaurateurs and, you know, oyster growers and cheesemakers and farmers and wine people. And it's an unending source of material where, you know, the thing is, if you have a home improvement show, like I tend to watch them sometimes on TV, but you know, if I get a home improvement show that's, let's say I'm redoing some bathrooms in my house out east, right? So if I got a show on bathrooms, I'm riveted, you know, but if it's a show on sealing your basement wall, you know, I'll pass. And I think that's where those shows kind of, you know, run out of audience share, because, you know, if you're not planning on sealing your basement wall that week or that month, you know, it really doesn't have any bearing unless you're just interested in the process. And I think more people are interested in the process of food than they are of sealing basement walls, to use a, you know, beat an example of death. But anyway, so Maybe we should talk about food for a couple minutes, right?
I mean, go to it, right Tom, in. Please.
Yeah, you know, I'm doing this thing next week. I've been dabbling with Mexican cuisine, which isn't my strong point, and for a couple of reasons. I mean, I've eaten really good Mexican food in Mexico, but I haven't had a lot of great Mexican food in the United States, and it probably has to do with where we're located. You know, Besito, when they first opened, did a great job. I haven't been there in a long time. I'm assuming they still do a great job. John Tunney, who's the owner, is a serious restaurant cat, so I think he's probably making sure that it's as good as it always was. But a lot of the restaurants, a lot of the Mexican restaurants that I've been to are basically red pile, brown pile, green pile, sour cream, you know. And everything has a different shape and a different name, but it's essentially the same ingredients. You have your rice, you have your pork, beef, and or fish, you know, and it comes in a taco, an empanada, you know, a chimichanga, a burrito, some black beans and some sour cream and tomatoes, you know. But I've kind of, lately I've been kind of investigating, I guess, some of the nuances of finer Mexican cuisine, and I'm finding them fascinating, you know. So anyway, we're doing this like kind of Mexican street fair thing, you know, where, you know, we have the street corn, you know, with the cotija cheese and the, you know, the lime and you know, chipotle aioli, and, you know, we're doing ropa vieja, an old Spanish national dish. I think it's Cuban in its incarnation, but you know, which is basically, you know, beef that's braised down to the point where it looks like an old ropa vieja being the old clothes, you know. You know, with olives and peppers and I'm getting into the chilies. You know, I made some sauces. I made a mild, a medium, and a run out of the building screaming kind of sauce, you know. So, you know, and I'm finding the different nuances of these chilies to be fascinating, because they have not only different heat levels, but different flavors.
I have to interject, though. We recently had a chili cook-off in our office, and where do you draw the line between a chowder and chili? And chowder might be the wrong term, but I guess there were some people that submitted something that was...
Soupy. Yeah, well, I think it's your personal preference. For me, chili is supposed... You'd be able to stand a spoon up in the chili, you know, I think. And it should be made with chunks of beef, not, you know, ground beef.
Oh, that's interesting, too, because I'm more familiar with ground beef, but there was... One of them was made with two different meats, and he said he cooked it so that it would fall apart
in the
mix. But... And even though when you say, you know, it should stand up to a spoon or whatever, some of them did, because there were big chunks of potatoes in the bottom.
Potatoes have no, you know, so, yeah, no. That's stew. That's not,
yeah,
they're, not they're, you.
His
you know.
Was a chicken chili, supposedly.
Yeah, well, that's
it
allowed.
It was a blanco, because it was
white,
but it was very brothy,
mm.
And it had chunks of potatoes, and
that sounds
happened
like
to have chicken. But
that's veering into the Jewish penicillin mode there, you know, it's the chicken soup, you know. Yeah, I mean, I've done chilies with lobster and shrimp, and I've done chilies with pork and beef and chicken and, you know, lamb and all the above.
But you're saying no ground beef, really?
I mean, it's not wrong. I mean, yeah, you can put it in, but I would rather have, you know... See, the thing with ground beef is you kind of never really know what it is, you know what I mean? If you have the piece of meat in front of you and you're dicing it, then you know exactly what you're dealing with. It's not wrong to have ground beef and chili. I mean, it's fine, you know. But I prefer, you know, I think a classier or more dressed-up version is, you know, with chunks of beef where you could see that it's made with, you know, a fresh cut of meat. And, you know, I use a lot of times I'll use... there's parts of the sirloin steak that I can't serve as a steak because it has grain running through it, you know, or sinew, stuff like that, you know. So what I'll do is I'll take those pieces out, I'll trim the sinew off, and, you know, I'll save them, and then I'll chunk them up and I'll use them for chili. So my chili is essentially made with prime sirloin, you know, rather than ground beef, which is, you know, there's a big difference. So, but, I, you know, either or, I mean, it's fine if you make chili with you know, most people's experience with chili, I think, is ground beef. You know, you have it on hot dogs at the stadium or, you know, the street vendor or whatever. You know, you go to these, like, sort of semi-fast food places, Applebee's or, you know, Miller's Ale House and places like that, you order chili, you're probably going to get ground beef. But if you, you know, if you have somebody that's really, you know, kind of versed in it, you know, and I don't think chili is a Mexican thing. I think it's a Southwestern thing or a Southern thing, really, you know. But I think if you make it...
Yeah, like Tex-Mex, as they say.
If you make it with... I would make it with, you know, short rib or any kind of brisket. It'd be a great, you know, choice for that. So those are the... You know, it's essentially a braise, you know. I mean, it's a braise that's not made with a sauce. It's made kind of like into a, you know, a stew or a paste, you know. But there's interesting ingredients. I mean, I use, you know, when I make chili, I use cinnamon in chili. I use chocolate in my chili. I use, you know, a couple of different kinds of chilies themselves, you know, to get the different heat levels or whatever. But it's fun. And, you know, I think a lot of times, you know, although I use it to use up some things, you know, like use up cuts of meat that I can't serve as a steak, it's not like a leftover situation. I treat it like it's its own magnificent thing, you know, as best I can. So, but you know, if you know, I could give you a chili recipe, probably not off the top of my head because there's a lot of things involved. But if you can go to, you know, on the internet and you get a million chili recipes, but you should check some of the other ones out. Like I used to do a lobster and black bean chili that was a big hit years ago. And, you know, lobsters being expensive now, it's probably not the time to do it, but you know, you can make a shrimp chili that's magnificent. You know, lamb is another great one because it has that little more of an assertive flavor, you know, if you like that. And pork, you know, slow roasted pork, you know, is a great chili additive. And a lot of times what you can do with that is you can braise the pork ahead of time and pull it almost like a pulled pork thing and then use that in your chili to fatten it up, which is always a good idea. So, you know, check those things out. I mean, and again, start... You know, if you haven't really investigated a lot of Mexican cuisine, it's culturally, it's a magnificent bunch of products, and there's great ways to use them. And you know, just the little things like making your own tortilla shells for tacos is so much different than the store-bought ones. And you can find good store-bought ones, don't get me wrong, but they never taste like the ones you make, you know, like grandma would make, you know. I have a Honduran woman who's been working with me for a long time. Her name is Carmen, and she makes all my tacos for me, you know, my tortilla shells. And she's like, she's a machine. I mean, she can knock out 100 of these things in 15 minutes. It's hilarious. As long as I do the rolling, I got to pinch the thing off and roll it. And she's got that little thing that she pats them down, you know, she's got the plastic on both sides, and she kind of leaves them on a towel to sort of half dry out a little bit, and then she, you know, sautés them, I mean, grills them, and, you know, it's just, it's fun to watch her because she's so good at it, you know. And I said, where'd you pick that up? So my grandmother, you know, and her grandmother taught her mother, and her mother taught her, and, you know, and she's teaching me. I guess I'm the next one in line or whatever. You know? But it's to me, the cultural differences, you know, which is amazing, you know, not to get off on the State of the Union, but, you know, cultural differences should be celebrated. I mean, why are we at war all the time? It's like crazy, right? I mean, you know, always looking at each other suspiciously. And, you know, I've said this time and time again, if you concentrate on the food of a culture, it's hard to be mad at somebody that you're eating with, you know? So, you know, share that culture, you know? I mean, like I said, I've had great meals in Mexico. But, you know, we're not in, like, Southern California, where there's a lot of Mexican immigrants, or Texas, you know, where the Tex-Mex food and the Mexican food and the restaurants are, from what I understand, so much better in those places because you have the original articles there, you know, the people who know the cuisine who came up and brought it with them. Here, not so much. Here, it's not. We don't have a huge Mexican population in New York. It's more Central American, you know. So I tend to have had more of those dishes. I even ate goey one time, which is hamster. Or guinea pig, you know, like it's just kind of a national dish down in
I know in Germany and Austria they use hamster fur to make fur-lined coats.
Well, yeah, but you don't eat a coat, you know what I mean? So I'm just talking about the, you know, the ingestion of it, you know. And you know, I did it for two reasons. I did it out of curiosity, and I did it out of respect for the guys that work for me who were excited about it, you know. And it was kind of stringy. It didn't taste like much, you know, whatever. You know, I wouldn't go out and have it again, you know, if I could avoid it. But I think that, you know, to just indulge yourself and immerse yourself in some of these other cultures, even if it's for just a meal for an hour, is a great thing to do. And it's educational, it's enjoyable, it's all of the things that you would want to have all rolled into one. You know, I mean, how many times, I remember the first time I went to a Seder, right? I was at this Seder dinner. I was probably in my 30s. You know, not being Jewish, I never went to a lot of Seders. So my friend invited me to his Seder, which was, he was doing the cooking. He had all first growth wines. It was crazy. And he said to me at the end, he says, "So what'd you think?" I said, "Well, you know, this is one of the few times that I actually had a ball and learned something at the same time. You know, most learning situations require some effort and, you know, diligence and head scratching. It's like going to school. It's arduous, you know. Research is arduous, you know. Sitting there drinking first growth wines and listening to, you know, about, you know, people's history for 2,000 years. That was fun. You know, it was a lot of fun. So I think that, you know, not to beat a dead horse, but, you know, if you can find something, Chinese food, Mexican food or whatever, and just forget about going to the restaurants. Just, you know, start researching a little bit on the internet. It's a great tool. It's the encyclopedia on steroids. And try some of these things at home. You know, try making your own. You know, try something simple, making your own tortilla shells. It's really simple to do. You know, it's not hard. And the rewards are so much greater than the store-bought stuff, you know. Make your own black beans instead of buying that can of Goya black beans, you know. Get some dried beans, soak them overnight, get them soft, you know, add some bacon, add some, you know, achiote paste or whatever you're going to do that you haven't done before. And what it'll do, it'll expand your culinary vocabulary. It'll, you know, please the palate 9 times out of 10, unless you completely blow the meal, which happens sometimes. But, and you'll learn something at the same time. You'll learn, you'll have a whole new respect for why cultures have different things. You know, why does Italy have pasta? Well, because Marco Polo brought it from China. You know, China has as much, if not more, pasta than Italy. You know, why do they use so much corn in Mexico? Because that's what they grow down there. You know, they're able to take what they have and turn it into all these wonderful things, you know. So anyway, that's Tommy's, you know, rant for the week. But I think that, you know, the more you can expand your culinary repertoire, the more fun you'll have in the kitchen, and you know, the more people you'll be able to please. I mean, and it's funny, people are proud of that. You know, when I start screwing around in the kitchen with the things that the guys, you know, have from their homeland, you know, I'll show them a different way to make rice. I mean, my guys eat rice every day. I always have this expression, un día sin arroz es como un día sin sol, which means a day without rice is like a day without sunshine. They all get a kick out of that because they eat rice every day. Or I'll show them my take on black beans, you know, and they call mine gringo tacos. Hey, you making a gringo tacos again, you know? And nobody gets mad. It's just fun, you know? It's fun to explore those different things. Anyway, so that's it for this week. We're going to have to go. I thank you for listening, and I thank you for making us the number 2 listened program on Sunday mornings. And we're going to close with Tom's 3 keys to life, which are, as usual, life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last and keep chocolate in your life. Damn it, as important as sex and pizza. See you next week.
Start your weekend with Santa Giada Pinot Grigio, a product of Savorian Inc., a local import wine company operated by Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander. Enjoy the crisp, refreshing flavors of peach and green apple in this medium-bodied, creamy mouthfeel wine that pairs with many foods. Santa Giada Pinot Grigio is exclusively available at Stu Leonard's Wines and Spirits of Farmingdale and Ryan's Wines in East Meadow. For more wine suggestions like Santa Giada Pinot Grigio, just email Chad at savorianwine.com.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.
Sweet Fancy Long Island is the award-winning dessert and pastry company that has become one of the hottest sources for bakery treats available for delivery on Long Island. Each mouthwatering creation has a personality all its own, teasing the palate with its rich flavors, complex textures, and eye-catching presentations. All items at Sweet Fancy Long Island are made 100% from scratch using the highest quality ingredients: Belgian chocolate, European butter, vanilla beans from Tahiti, and the richest, most flavorful fruits available. Their clients can enjoy any one of our delectable confections from one-of-a-kind pastries, specialty and occasion cakes, French macarons, and karma cups. Their signature line includes an assortment of charming personalized sized desserts served in miniature mason jars. The Sweet Fancy Long Island team takes great pride in presenting a unique, delicious, and elegant dessert experience and works closely with every client to create a memorable dessert that will add an exciting dimension to any celebration. Presently, the work of Sweet Fancy Long Island have been found in some of the area's top restaurants, country clubs, gourmet shops, catering facilities, and Food Network. Go to sweetfancyli.com to order online or to view their incredible gallery of desserts.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.